we begin the hour by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Yes.
Good day, sir.
How are you?
I am I'm living the dream, of course. I'm here. I'm on the radio. I have a place to go every day, so I'm doing all right.
Hey, I just heard, just a joke, that Mr. Gronkowski is going to Tampa.
Yes, not a joke. He is going to Tampa. Apparently, the Patriots got a fourth-round draft pick for him.
You know, this guy, he irks me. Bloody Gronkowski. It sounds like a debauched sexual maneuver. You know what I mean. He is irritating, this post-retirement, now I'm back. I'm done with the wrestling I hardly started. I want to have the country club mentality with my NFL team, Gronkowski. Not a fan of this guy right now.
Well, I can understand that, and I have to assume this is not just a publicity thing. No one's going to give up a fourth pick for that, so I guess he's coming back, reunited, and it feels so good.
Yeah, there's something off-putting about people who need to be in a situation, right, where it's just like, oh, will you fluff my pillow for me? I want it to be so hunky-dory. I just don't like that. That just smacks of a kind of entitlement to me that I find nettlesome. It's just, I really don't like when people orient themselves around that kind of choice-making.
Entitlement among pro athletes, Colin?
You know what? I've kind of been a defender of Gronkowski, too, because he's not the meathead moron that people think he is. I'm not saying that he's like Aristotle, but he's certainly average or somewhat above average. Like, he really is. He's not that stupid a guy. I think it's part of his persona.
No, exactly.
But the whole reunited thing in Tampa, and we'll kind of run the team, and I just don't like it. There's just something off about it.
Hey, speaking of meatheads, your book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, I see you've got a cover image, a cover art that's ready to go. When might we see this in a bookstore near us?
Well, it's going to the printers soon. It won't be in bookstores because of the blackballing in the industry, but you can get it through Amazon, and it doesn't even have an official publication date. Normally what happens is there's a rollout, and reviewers get books like 3 or 4 months in advance. But when you are hated by an entire industry, even though you publish constantly, and that's part of the reason why you're hated, doesn't even really make sense to do any kind of a rollout. So it'll just be there. And it's funny, because Buried on the Beach has actually sold decently, especially for a book that had no coverage, not a single review in America from the guy who writes for all the famous venues. Simply by word of mouth and because of the places that I do write for, which just only goes to show that if there was any kind of backing whatsoever that anyone else would get, you'd be talking bestseller pretty easily. So, very funny book. And Gronkowski is actually, he's in it quite a bit. And the meathead Chad of the novel, entirely different kind of novel, funnier than Catch-22, you'll like it, is a huge Patriots fan. He showers and has a Patriots towel and he's an alcoholic. He has all other sorts of things going on. But Gronkowski and Brady are like his Peter and Paul, really. They come up quite a bit in his mental mulling.
Before we talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald today, I did want to tell you, you sent me a short story yesterday that was 900 words called Leavable. And I keep saying this to you, but it just blew me away. It was incredible.
It's funny you should mention that because people should check out. It's a really long one. There's going to be a blog. Most of it's all written after this radio segment. And it actually covers that story. And it sort of, in an indirect way, quotes you, because what people are saying whenever they read these stories, these unbiased, not insane readers, they're saying, how could it be that length? Because it doesn't seem like it's possible to put that much in there. And I kind of walk through the process of getting that much inside of a short story. Because that short story, in a way, ostensibly, is about a man whose father is going to die. And it's really, it's that hospital scenario playing out, but it's about a lot more than that. And the choices we make and sort of the shifting nature of friendship and how sometimes our best friends are people we don't know anymore. And so there's a lot going on. It works around this idea of how leavable a person is. Yeah. So this guy who's in this situation is he's not with his wife anymore. And she had said to him at one point that this is the hardest thing I've ever had to do because you're the most you're the least leavable person I've ever known. And that idea is this theme that comes up in the story that's only 900 words long, but life-wise, it's a trillion words long. And yet you can have this entire life literary experience in however long it takes you to read it, a couple minutes, 3 minutes, whatever it is. It's something that I've never seen anyone else do before. And you saw the first story in this sequence of stories like this called Jute. And it's almost like you've seen Doctor Who, right, where there's the TARDIS, and it's bigger on the inside than the outside, right? And I feel like these are kind of TARDIS stories in the sense that they're longer on the inside than they are on the outside. And it's just not something I've encountered done quite this way before.
That's a great description. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, a happy 100th anniversary to a couple of terrific works by F. Scott Fitzgerald, This Side of Paradise and Bernice Bobs Her Hair, turning 100 this year.
This Side of Paradise was his first novel, and it's really a hodgepodge. And it speaks to how different certain things were back then than they are now. So just to give you an idea how this novel came to be, Fitzgerald's at Princeton. He doesn't graduate Princeton. He was always this college fanboy, but he was never really accepted within the college cliques. It was something that was important to him, but at the same time, when he wrote, I feel like Fitzgerald had this guiding conscience that would steer him correctly in his judgments and his work, even when he couldn't steer himself correctly in how he lived his own life. Actually, he's the same age I am now when he died. He's 44 years old, so he didn't make it like very far into that life. And think of all the things that he might have written, but he was so prolific. And what he had was this fragment, 80-page fragment called The Romantic Egotist. And he wanted Zelda Sayre to marry him. And she's like, no, you're not in my class. This isn't going to happen. He's like, oh, baby girl, be easy with F. Scott Fitzgerald. How about I write this novel? I'll be famous. We'll get hitched. Brilliant. He's a weird guy, Fitzgerald. He actually wrote her therapist later saying that the first orgasm she ever had in her life was on their wedding night. So I don't know. Some things he was a little bit off on, I think, probably. And so he just cobbles together all these fragments, poems and stories that don't really fit. And these, like, I don't know how to really kind of bridge the gaps in my book. I'll do some stream of consciousness. And it's a sort of autobiographical novel. It's not sort of. It's bang on an autobiographical novel. And you can see who the Zelda Sayre character is. This other woman he had loved who wanted nothing to do with him eventually, who was in Lake Forest and Ginevra King. And he has this buddy. And he says to his buddy, he's like, hey, man, I need to marry this girl. I have this novel. I just kind of stuck it together. Can you bring it to Max Perkins at Scribner's? And the guy's like, yeah, okay, sure, he's my friend, I'll do that. So Fitzgerald's completely unpublished, and the manuscript is delivered by this go-between on September 4th. And no one at Scribner's wants to put it out. And Max Perkins is like, you know what, this guy's my friend, I don't want to make it awkward, let's just do it. And so Fitzgerald says, oh, okay, yeah, thanks, now I can get married. And by the way, can you do it this autumn? And they're like, no, man, you have to wait till the spring. So he grumbles about having to wait until the spring. Book comes out within 4 days by this guy who's completely unpublished, no one's ever heard of, and he has this really not very good book. It's sold out of its printing. And you see what I deal with on a daily basis with what I am up against. And it's like that gave Fitzgerald his chance. And he wasn't very good at the time. Now, what he did do was he got very good very swiftly. He became a master once he was given the opportunity. And that takes us to the second work from May of 1920, Bernice Bobs Her Hair, a short story.
And you're working on a piece about Fitzgerald for the American Interest. And among the things you write about, and we've talked about it with you before, this idea that you have to live a certain life to be able to write about it in a first-person sense. And if that were the case, there would be no Bernice Bobs His Hair because Fitzgerald was a man, Bernice was a woman. Well, that would just never work, right?
Yeah, nothing that we care about that lasts would exist if that was the prevailing directive, if that's how it always gone. Dickens wasn't a ghost, right? Stephen Crane was not a Civil War soldier, never had even been on a battlefield. Shakespeare was anything but a king. You can go on and on and on. And this whole thing right now is because what people in publishing want to do is they want to protect themselves. They want to protect their egos. And they want to say, well, you can't write about this. That's my official territory. Because they can't invent anything. So they want to limit what you can invent as someone who is an inventor. And this story, Bernice Bobs Her Hair, is about a teen girl, which, of course, Fitzgerald was not. He chased teen girls, but he certainly was not one of them. And he writes this story about this woman who is of mixed race. This was 100 years ago, and she's part Native American. And she is shipped off to the summer to this popular girl's house. And they rank on her. You know how kids are. They're mean, often. And she's not allowed into their little reindeer groups and everything. And to get the attention of a boy, which then becomes the attention of a lot of boys, she makes this boast. She says, I am going to bob my hair, which I guess now would be akin to saying, I am going to strut naked through the halls of school. So to me, I'm fire. You know how they talk in the Twitter. And so she's just saying this, but she becomes really popular. And the girl she's staying with becomes jealous. And she encroaches upon her. She importunes. She forces her to get her hair bobbed in front of these kids. And then they all laugh at her. So she leaves in the middle of the night. But what she does before she leaves, this is a nicely structured story, she goes into the room of the sleeping friend, who's not really a friend, on Sex and the City, you'd call them a frenemy, and she cuts off her beautiful tresses. And then she goes across the street to this boy that this girl likes, and she throws the tresses onto the doorstep and goes and catches the train. It's really well structured, and if you look at it next to This Side of Paradise, you'd think, there's no way, man, that that's the same guy. But he had the chance, and now he was rolling.
Colin, what do you mean when you talk about the college novel in the post-liberal arts age?
That the liberal arts education is dead. I don't think it ever really existed. Now, I've read every single line that F. Scott Fitzgerald ever wrote, including his notebooks, his letters. We'll come to the notebooks in a second. But I was just receiving D's, F's, and C's in college, in Boston College. And I just thought, you know what? These people, they don't know anything. They're all these failed writers. And they're all just people who hook each other up. I stopped going to class. I started reading F. Scott Fitzgerald and all the other things that they weren't going to teach me because they were just regurgitating these awful books by their cronies. And I wasn't going to get any better with that. I started writing professionally when I was 20 years old, and I learned that this is essentially a class structure. And Fitzgerald was the same way. Some of the smartest people that I've ever known, Fitzgerald, Orson Welles, Bob Dylan, they don't work with college. So you have this college novel, apparently. It's the celebration of college, but it's not the celebration of college. Amory Blaine is this fop. It's almost like saying that The Magnificent Ambersons is a celebration of a kind of old money. And it's not. It's a very sad book. It's a very sad movie by Orson Welles. It's this send-up. It starts off in this funny way of the notion of comeuppance, but it becomes tragedy. And I think Fitzgerald, he always had that rudder, is how I described in the piece that I wasn't able to finish in time to get to you. When he was writing, this rudder always kept him on course as a thinker, as a person, even when he couldn't keep himself on course in his own life, which he could really make a jumble of. So I think you have this satire, essentially, of the college experience. You go and someone tells you, hey, this is what you need to look at. And that's not how learning works. Now, I mean, maybe if your teacher was Socrates, guarantee you if you go to a museum with me for a couple hours and we walk around Boston, you won't see the world the same way again. But for the most part, it's people on autopilot who are just rolling the log for other people.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. You also sent me what you say is arguably the best thing Fitzgerald ever wrote. I had never read it before. It's short and it packs a punch. Talk a little bit, if you can, about Our April Letter.
It's from his notebooks, and I think I posted on Twitter that probably less than 100 people in the world, I would wager, have read this. It's tucked away. It's not unpublished. I didn't have to, like, dig it out of his old home or something like that. But it's the scrap he wrote in this. It's kind of fragmented and short. I'll read it. But it's not what you would. Everyone just says The Great Gatsby. And listen to how devastating this is. It's just a fragment he wrote to himself. This is April again. Roller skates rain slowly down the street, your voice far away on the phone. Once I would have jumped like a clown through a hoop, but then the area of infection has increased. Oh, what can I expect after all? I've had worse shocks. Anyhow, I know, and that's something. Like hell it is. But it's what you say to an x-ray doctor. In the past, whispering faint now on another phone. Is there any change? Little or no change. I see. The roller skates ring down the streets. The black cars shine between the leaves. Your voice far away. I am going with my daughter to the country. My husband left today. No, he knows nothing. Good. I have asked a lot of my emotions. 120 stories. The price was high, right up with Kipling. Because there was one little drop of something, not blood, not a tear, not my seed, but me more intimately than these in every story. It was the extra I had. Now it is gone, and I am just like you now. Once the file was full, here is the bottle it came in. Hold on, there's a drop left there. No, it was just the way the light fell. But your voice on the telephone. If I hadn't abused words, so what you said might have meant something. But 120 stories. April evening spreads over everything. The purple blur left by a child who has used the whole paint box.
There are whole novels that don't have that much emotion.
Yeah, and that's, again, he was in his late 30s when he wrote that. And he's saying 120 stories, because for all of the money, all of the waste, and all of the money he drank away and the life they lived, this guy would lock himself in a room for a week over his attic, and he would just crank it. He worked. People now, they very rarely write. People are terrified of the writing experience. People in publishing. I found that more so than the fancy places I'm in all the time, the thing that intimidates people the most, or close to it, is the productivity.
Right.
It really bothers people. And he was someone who was always productive when it was a better thing, and I hope it'll be a better thing again to be productive.
I agree with you on that. Hope it will be as well. Check out Colin's work at his blog, the Many Moments More blog, ColinFlemingLit.com. Always a pleasure, my friend. Hope your week goes well, and we'll check in next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown.